this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Durham's 10 Game-Changing Projects. Hundreds of millions of dollars are flowing into downtown Durham for new city projects that could transform the city by 2020. That's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Money flows into Durham to shape city. The city of Medicine is undergoing a massive growth curve as outside money pours into its urban core for mixed-use projects. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. Brewmaster Kyle Jansen is not a trailblazer, he admits readily. But when he and his partner stumbled on a deal to buy an old paint warehouse in downtown Durham's gritty east side for the new home of Ponysaurus Brewing Company, there was little doubt a modern-day resurgence of a storied downtown was underway again. Ponysaurus's building is about a half mile from the American Tobacco Campus, Durham Bulls Athletic Park, and the city's renowned Performing Arts Center. But since it's surrounded by construction suppliers and auto repair shops, it might as well be a world away. The partners reasoned that the building, located at the corner of Hood and Ramsar Streets, was affordable and large enough to fit a brewery, tap room, and beer garden. It could work, they thought. Then, a week after making their offer to buy the property, news leaked that a Charlotte real estate developer, with plans for a $400 million mixed-use development project, was buying an old auto dealership lot about a block away. Across from the brewery, the city purchased 4.5 acres for construction of the new Durham Police Headquarters. Property values on that side of town were mounting quickly. I was worried that someone would come in under us and pay cash for our spot, Jansen says. Our timing turns out to have been great. Primed for projects. It's not just Durham's east side. All of Durham's downtown district is at a tipping point. The city's stock of empty historic tobacco buildings and textile mills that has spurred much of the new private investment in the downtown district over the past 20 years is about tapped out. Vacant office space downtown is almost non-existent and limited to small blocks for companies of fewer than 20 employees. The lack of available space has been blamed for curbing economic development efforts to draw more people and jobs into the city. Parking and housing options as well are becoming premium commodities. All that could be changing soon, though. Construction of more than a dozen new public and private building projects valued at nearly $1 billion are slated to begin going vertical by mid-2017. Nearly all of the new buildings proposed are bigger, taller, and more expensive than anything Durham's seen in decades. It truly is the end of the beginning, says Scott Selig, Associate Vice President of Capital Assets and Real Estate at Duke University, who's helped place a number of Duke University-affiliated research groups and campus employers in buildings downtown. There really is nothing left to redevelop, he says. The university, for example, will be an anchor tenant at the Chesterfield, a former cigarette manufacturing plant on Duke Street. That is the last of the big, empty historic buildings left to be converted into new office space. Baltimore-based Wexford Science and Technology bought the building in late 2013 and is in the process of turning the historic structure into a hub for Durham Life Sciences companies, a project that will cost about $128 million when completed in mid-2017. Duke University is also expected to be a key tenant and partner at the campus of Durham ID, a collaboration between Longfellow Real Estate Partners of Boston and Durham-based Measurement Incorporated. The campus on the north side of downtown expects to break ground on the first two new office and research laboratory buildings by late 2016. Selig says he has plenty more Duke researchers and staff asking to be moved downtown, but there's nothing yet to offer them. We're 99.5% leased up right now in downtown, he says. It's a wonderful problem to have. Outside dollars stream in. Jeff Durham, president and CEO of the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, says he has been fielding a lot of questions and calls from both developers and companies seeking to expand in downtown Durham. I'm really proud how projects like the Durham Hotel and Jack Tar Hotel give a nod to what Durham was and its history. But that product doesn't change the skyline like a lot of these other projects will. Like Chesterfield, much of the new investment in downtown Durham is coming from outside the Triangle market. Developers and investors from Charlotte, Boston, the Washington, D.C. metro area, and Aspen, Colorado. All are bullish about the market possibilities in Durham, but nobody knows just how deep that market is or how long it will last, an important criteria for any debt or equity partner asked to help finance these risky multi-million dollar projects. The truth is, the office supply is limited, and on the demand side, there are these companies that have been incubating and growing downtown who are at a tipping point in their growth and need space, says Justin Parker, Chesterfield's senior project manager. The worst outcome would be that we've got these homegrown companies and, for lack of space, they have to go somewhere else. The start of construction of the 27-story One City Center Tower project on Corcoran Street, for example, took nearly a year longer than anticipated, primarily because the development team had trouble securing all of the financing it needed to begin the $80 million project. The building is now on track to finish in early 2018. Others are moving on a faster track. In 2015, Charles Lindsay McAlpine, managing partner of Charlotte-based CitySculpt, bought the 12-acre former Hendrick Auto Mall property at the Durham Freeway and South Roxborough Street and has already sold off a piece of the property for the new Gateway Center Apartments. He says he's in final negotiations with an equity partner to begin construction of a 200,000-square-foot speculative office building at Gateway by early 2017. We've had a lot of interest from financial institutions to be a backer in our projects, so we're feeling good about what's happening in Durham, McAlpine says. Sandwiched between the CitySculpt site and the DPAP, another development group led by Northwood Raven has purchased the former Elkins Chrysler dealership lot with plans to build a $75 million 10-story office building and an $80 million high-end apartment building, both of which are expected to start before year-end. And on the west side of the DPAP, plans are underway to relocate the University Ford Kia auto dealership to a new site on US 15501 in South Durham. Owner Tony Fisher says he hasn't yet submitted construction plans to the city for the new site and estimates the dealership could remain at the current location for another 24 months. But he's already fielding calls from buyers interested in the 11-acre downtown site. We've had a tremendous amount of interest, but we have not actively marketed the property to date, he says. One potential suitor for the University Ford site, but not yet confirmed, is the owner of the nearby American Tobacco Campus, the real estate arm of Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Corporation. Michael Goodman, vice president of real estate at CBC, wouldn't confirm nor deny his company's interest in buying the Ford dealership site, but Goodman has been open about the need for more office space downtown to capture companies that are needing to expand. You're going to start seeing more developers jockeying for position, says Marcus Jackson, head of the Urban Investments Group at Trademark Properties in Raleigh, who has focused much of his attention the past 4 years on properties in downtown Durham. The development community is scouting downtown right now, is scouring downtown right now, he says. Yet, for the guys at Ponysaurus Brewing Company, it's all good news since they own their building and can't be kicked out now by an established enterprising landlord. The funny thing is, any building you can see from here is in some sort of transition now, Jansen says. It's either listed for sale, under contract, or already sold, which is good. We want more neighbors. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. The first headline, Good Night Trumped, Carrie Chef Bids Adieu. The Trump International Hotel and Tower Chicago has lured away the Umstead Hotel and Spa's pastry chef, Evan Sheridan, only 2 years after Sheridan had moved to the area from the inn at Little Washington in Virginia. At Trump Tower, Sheridan will be overseeing the dessert programs at the property's three restaurants. Umstead Hotel General Manager Jim Beely, though, has already found a replacement. The hotel and its Hirons restaurant has hired Johnson & Wales University graduate Jonathan Fisher, formerly the pastry chef and sous chef at One in Chapel Hill, to succeed Sheridan. Practicum's newest exec, lure of Tesla had little influence. In the end, the promise of leasing a new Tesla Model 3 played only a minor role in attracting a new president to Practicum. It did not influence me that much, says Vikas Padhi, who joined the Morrisville-based company on June 7. I was driven more by the mission of Practicum and what we have set out to accomplish. Practicum designed a device called Arista Slice that researchers use to run early experiments on disease-fighting proteins that they could develop into new drugs. Company founder and CEO Nick DeMarco has promised to lease a new Tesla Model 3 for each and every employee if and when Tesla releases the new sedan. Although Padhi says he is looking forward to the car, he says he is more excited about the work the company is doing. I just get goosebumps thinking about what we are developing and what we will develop in the future. Untappd co-founder lures craft brewers to join network. The mobile beer tracking app Untappd, spelled Untappd, has a new addition, Untappd for Business. This new app lets local bottle shops and breweries publish and share their current beer menus on Untappd, as well as many other social media outlets. Untappd co-founder and chief technology officer Greg Avola talked to Biz and says this will allow the businesses to tap into the 3 million plus users of Untappd in real time. The Triangle area already has a handful of businesses using this app to help secure more drinkers when that rare beer hits the taps. Currently, 9 local companies use the new addition, including Clouds Brewing, Patty O'Beers, Linwood Brewing Concern, Boxcar, Growler Girls, and Isaac Hunters. And here's a bit more information from the conversation with Avola. How did you come up with the idea for creating the Untappd application? My partner, Tim Mather, and I came up with the idea of Untappd after thinking about the concepts of Foursquare, a location check-in service, in respect to different specific industries. We found that the beer industry was inherently social, but there wasn't a real-time aspect of it on the web, and thus Untappd was born. We wanted to help users be able to share the beer they are having and share them with friends, as well as get recommendations in the process. How many check-ins, distinct beers, and total badges do you own? As of this writing, 2,702 check-ins, 1,563 beers, and 582 badges. Biz virtually has Avola beat with 2,637 check-ins, 2,040 beers, and 685 badges. Just saying. Do you know how many people have achieved the Uber badge for drinking 10,000 different beers? There are 4 people out of the 3.3 million plus users on Untappd who have got this already. Very small ratio. What's your all-time favorite fallback beer? I really enjoy Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. It's usually always available, and it's really delicious and easy drinking. Other than possibly drinking, what are a few of your favorite hobbies? Technology and coding are something I am really passionate about. Local NFL star returns to host youth camp in Holly Springs. Indianapolis Colts linebacker and Apex High School graduate Snorcy C.O. Moore will be making a trip back to the Triangle this July and will be bringing about 45 of his NFL friends along with him for a showcase event at the North Main Athletic Complex in Holly Springs. Moore and friends will be holding a free youth football camp, the Reach for More Camp for Kids, on July 16 for campers in grades 2 through 12. It will be open to the first 500 kids who sign up and will also include a meet and greet with the players and a cookout for all who attend. The event was born out of an idea that Moore and his friend Troy Mangus of Holly Springs, the business development manager at the Davidson & Jones Construction Company in Raleigh, had talked about over dinner on one of Moore's recent trips back home to visit family. Mangus says all of the NFL players who will be participating, a group that includes both active and retired players from across the country, are donating their time. Mirror, mirror on the street, who may we show our next tweet? Selfies, anyone? The city of Raleigh has announced its new social media initiative, #ReflectRaleigh. It's a traveling mirror that will be placed in various locales around the city awaiting your selfies. Its first spot, Exchange Plaza between Wilmington and Fayetteville Streets in downtown Raleigh. Follow the #ReflectRaleigh # on Twitter to find out where it will be next. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Durham's 555 Mangum takes shape. Northwood Raven plans $75 million 10-story building. The development team from Charlotte and Triangle-based Northwood Raven unveiled plans for its next big project in the region. A 10-story office and retail building called 555 Mangum, which will be built in partnership with Acreage, a Washington, D.C.-based real estate development firm. The $75 million 555 Mangum building will be Acreage's first commercial project in the Triangle. Designs for the new 10-story, 225,000-square-foot office building are still being tweaked and must pass muster with Durham planning officials, but the goal so far is to begin grading the site for construction in fall 2016, says Jeff Furman, director of Northwood Raven's Real Raleigh operations. Northwood Raven acquired the property, the site of the former Elkins Chrysler auto dealership lot at the corner of Mangum Street and Jackie Robinson Drive in 2015, and will be self-developing the project's second building that will feature about 400 high-end apartment units. The apartment piece has been valued at around $80 million. Projected delivery date for both buildings would be in late 2018. Area's award-winning Foursquare restaurant to close. Shane Ingram and Elizabeth Woodhouse, co-owners of one of Durham's most celebrated high-class restaurants, Foursquare Restaurant, have announced that they will be closing the business permanently as of June 25. Foursquare has been a AAA Four Diamond Award winner, one of the most prestigious awards for the hotel and restaurant industry since 2001. Real estate sources say the owners had been trying to find a buyer for both the restaurant business and the 4,570-square-foot renovated historic home at 2701 Chapel Hill Road, but they have yet to find a suitable proposal. Custom-made burger franchise coming to South Point Mall. One of the first franchise owners of Built, a new burger spinoff of California-based The Counter, custom-built burgers, has signed a lease to open the company's first North Carolina location at the food court inside the streets at South Point Mall in South Durham. The owners have plans to open five locations throughout the Triangle. The Durham Mall outlet is set to open in July. The Counter Eatery will feature a build-your-own burger line, similar to what Chipotle had done for burritos and what Mod Pizza has done for individual pizzas. Walmart grocery developer seeks rezoning in Durham. A South Carolina retail developer's plan to build a 20-acre grocery-anchored retail center on North Roxborough Street in Durham is on the agenda for discussion at the next Durham Planning Commission meeting on June 14. WRS Incorporated of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, is seeking permission to build up to 54,113 square feet of retail, including a 41,117-square-foot anchor grocery store, according to the site plans filed with the city. The property is at the intersection of North Roxborough Street and Argonne Drive. WRS hasn't disclosed yet the anchor tenant for the center, but the plan fits the profile of a standard Walmart neighborhood market store. WRS has developed multiple Walmart store buildings on behalf of the retail giant across the Southeast. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, TransEnterics' next move critical. In the span of 12 trading days in early April, Research Triangle Park surgical robot developer TransEnteric raised $26.3 million, increasing its cash position by nearly 40% in that time frame. That money was earmarked for a commercial launch of a new minimally invasive surgical robot called Surgibot, for which the company and CEO Todd Pope held high hopes. On April 19, however, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration denied TransEnterics' application for Surgibot, something that abruptly changed the course of the company. Pope has made few public comments since April 19, and the additional cash had not been previously reported. There was no reference to the funds in an earnings release, though was disclosed in the 10Q filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the detailed quarterly report all publicly traded companies must file. As of April 30, TransEnterics had cash and cash equivalents of $74.6 million, money that will now be used for commercial expansion of a different surgical robot called ALF-X in Europe, as well as potential regulatory application in the United States. In September, while TransEnterics was awaiting a ruling from FDA on Surgibot, it acquired the surgical robotics division of Sofar SPA, an Italian healthcare company, in a deal that could be worth $100 million. Sofar developed the Telelap ALF-X robotic system for minimally invasive surgery, which TransEnterics intended to combine with Surgibot, but can also develop independently. On a conference call with analysts to discuss the FDA rejection and first quarter results, Pope said that he had given the sales team an aggressive goal to sell a system in the first quarter. Even though we haven't closed that initial sale, we continue to expand our pipeline and our confidence continues to be emboldened through our interactions with customers, Pope said on the May 10 call. Pursuing these situations certainly provided the potential to close one of these accounts in the first quarter, and while these opportunities have not yet converted into a sale, most are still active deals, and we continue to be engaged with them. So far, so good. These hospital interactions have validated much of our thinking, and we've learned some new things that reinforce our confidence. In the near term, TransEnterics will pivot its focus to Europe. The ALF-X device is not approved for sale in the U.S., but has passed regulatory approval in Europe. Following the FDA rejection on Surgibot, TransEnterics laid off an estimated 50 employees in the U.S., about 40% of its workforce in this country. However, the 30 employees in Europe that came to TransEnterics from Sofar were kept with the company, and the company will look to generate revenue from sales in Europe while it evaluates options in the U.S. Longtime exec Ogle retires from CRO giant Inc. Research. Jim Ogle retired as board chairman of Inc. Research, the pharmaceutical research group he has led since 2003. The move was effective immediately, and Ogle is succeeded by David Norton, who joined the board in February 2015. The announcement came with no prior indication that Ogle, who is 72, would step down. Ogle was not available for comment, and Inc. did not provide a statement from him. Ogle was CEO of Inc. Research from 2003 to 2013, and followed by Jamie McDonald, who took the company through an initial public offering in late 2014. Metabolon cuts deal with Johns Hopkins Tufts to develop tool. Research Triangle Park Metabolomics developer Metabolon has reached a deal with two healthcare titans to develop a new tool to help in diagnosing chronic kidney disease. Kidney disease can be caused by diabetes, a growing epidemic worldwide. A diagnostic test to better identify early stages of kidney disease, when it is still treatable, could serve as a valuable role. Metabolon reached the deal with Johns Hopkins University and Tufts Medical Center to develop a test that will require just one blood sample, something that would make it easier on both doctors and patients to get a readout of kidney function. Existing tests to measure kidney function are complex and invasive. Metabolon was founded in 2000 and has raised $65 million in five rounds of funding. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "We are working hard to make the Affordable Care Act work for our customers and our company. The federal government's failure to honor its legal obligations contributed significantly to our ACA losses in 2014 and 2015 and makes it more challenging for our company to continue selling ACA products to our customers." And that's from Brad Wilson, President and CEO of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, after the insurer sued the federal government for payments it says it is owed relating to ACA plans. And finally, in the section called Big Numbers, $8 billion market value lost by Biogen in one day, June 7, after it reported failed results for a trial on an experimental drug intended to repair past damage to neurons from multiple sclerosis or other diseases. And now we turn to On Tech and Transportation, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline on this page, new money for undercover colors. Raleigh rape drug detecting firm completes funder. To say undercover colors in development product is highly anticipated is an understatement. Its idea to create a nail polish that changes colors when exposed to a date rape drug has gone viral, attracting headlines and conversations across the globe. And this month, the company disclosed in a securities filing that it had raised $3 million. It's the third funder for NC State University chemistry startup, which in all has raised more than $3.3 million since 2014. While the company has yet to release a product, it is testing a prototype, according to co-founder Tyler Confrey Maloney, who said via prepared statement following the funding announcement that the cash signals the exciting times ahead for undercover colors. The quality of investors we continue to attract is a testament to the important advances we've made with our novel technology, he said. According to a securities disclosure, 15 investors participated in the round, which is capped at $4.5 million, meaning the company has $1.5 million left to raise. Listed in the filing are Protochip CEO David Nakashi and Burt's Bees Vice President of Research and Development Celeste Lutrario, both as directors. As building ownership changes hands, HQ Raleigh charts robust expansion plans. HQ Raleigh is still building an expansion, now planned to be a 2.5-floor structure across the street from its current Raleigh headquarters. But ownership has officially changed hands. Centerline Properties, the real estate arm of Centerline Digital CEO Charles Long, has bought the property, which used to be the old William Cozart Furniture Facility on West Street. Centerline, which also owns HQ Raleigh's Harrington Street headquarters, purchased the property from the HQ Investor Group, which consists of entrepreneurs Christopher Gergen, Jesse Lipson, Brooks Bell, and Jason Wyden, at a purchase price of $1.2 million. HQ investors had purchased the property for $900,000 in February 2015, meaning a $300,000 profit for just over a year of ownership. HQ, which has a three-city co-working footprint, Raleigh, Greensboro, and Charlotte, plans to open a new co-working hub in Charleston, South Carolina, in the coming months. RDU unveils concepts to meet future demand. New transportation systems and new runways, their concepts being discussed by Raleigh-Durham International Airport officials right now as ways to meet the growing need of its travelers. The airport released 9 conceptual drawings last month detailing several potential plans, including the addition of a Terminal 3, a new transportation center, and an underground transportation system to transport travelers between terminals. The airport is currently soliciting public comment on its plans. RDU will have another public meeting June 28, where they'll present four compromise concepts. Eventually, the airport hopes to fund implementation of one plan with the help of federal and state dollars. Gartner, Lenovo losing market share in server market. A new Gartner report shows that across the globe, server revenue decreased 2.3% year over year in the first quarter of 2016. During that same time period, shipments of the devices grew 1.7%. Since acquiring IBM's RTP-based server division 2 years ago, Lenovo has been emphasizing its enterprise business segment, and its server revenue is estimated to have declined by more than 10%. Shipments were down 9.6% year over year. And finally, in a section called She Said It, the quote, I'm very interested in plugging into the collaborations that are happening in North Carolina and having Wilmington being an active participant. And that's a comment from Diane Durance, new director of UNCW's Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And turning to some general news stories, Maine Pharma's drug gets FDA approval. This article written by Jason DeBruin. Maine Pharma, which is in the middle of a 5-year, $65 million expansion in Greenville, has received regulatory approval for a generic version of Ticosin, a drug made by Pfizer. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved Maine to manufacture and market diflunisal capsules, an antiarrhythmic agent used to treat irregular heartbeats, such as atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter. According to IMS Health, annual sales of Ticosin in the United States were about $200 million for the 12 months that ended with April. As the first generic to enter the market, Maine also received 180 days of market exclusivity. Maine Pharma, which is based in Australia and has U.S. headquarters in Raleigh, has been on a steep growth curve. In February, Maine reported $127 million in sales for the first half of fiscal 2016, a 114% increase from the first half of fiscal 2015. Similarly, reported net profit for the first half was $19 million, a whopping 380% increase from the first half of 2015. The launch of Maine Pharma's capsules with 180 days of market exclusivity represents a large step forward in our company's growth, underscoring our commitment through our staff and investments to bring complex generic alternatives to the marketplace, said Stephen Cross, president of Maine Pharma USA, in a statement. Maine says it anticipates the new facility being completed and open for business by early 2018. In the pharmaceutical industry, there is a regulatory validation of equipment and processes for expansions like this. The plant will be fully functional for all intents and purposes, but not producing products or services for external clients. The facility will be fully functional for the purpose of validation by the middle of 2017, which is when Maine Pharma would bring on most of the 110 new jobs for which it has committed. Wells Fargo shifts 55 jobs from California to Charlotte. Wells Fargo and Company has some bad news for the San Francisco Bay Area, but good news for Charlotte. On June 7, when the bank said it would transfer 55 jobs from Oakland, California to the Queen City. While still committed to serving the Bay Area, the company has decided to move some functions within its commercial mortgage servicing, CMS business, that were being performed in dual locations in Oakland and Charlotte, and consolidate them within its Charlotte CMS office, said Wells Fargo spokesman Ruben Polito. San Francisco-based Wells Fargo's largest concentration of employees is in the Charlotte metro area, where it has about 23,500 workers. It has about 17,000 workers in the Bay Area, including 8,000 in San Francisco. Company-wide, the bank has about 269,000 employees. Other financial giants have also moved jobs out of the Bay Area recently. Charles Schwab has moved thousands of jobs in recent years out of its hometown office of San Francisco, while J.P. Morgan Chase was quick to move back office credit card jobs out of the East Bay when it purchased the failed Washington Mutual, which had previously acquired credit card issuer Providian, which was based in San Francisco. And now we turn to the executive voice column. And the focus on this is on Carolyn Sperano. The headline, there's a new chief in town. Bronto's new site lead, Sperano, sets goal for bigger presence. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. A year after Bronto's $200 million buyout by NetSuite, there's change at the top. Longtime executive Carolyn Sperano has taken over as general manager and site lead for Durham-based email marketing company Bronto. And, armed with the NetSuite wallet, she's got bullish plans for Bronto. The firm plans to hire at least 90 people this year, with half of those positions being hired right here in Durham. But things could have been very different. Sperano, who has a history of working for global companies, almost didn't take the Bronto job 10 years ago. After all, it was a big bet on a couple of guys, an email marketing product, and a 12-man team that hadn't raised any venture capital. And technology, where she spent the bulk of her career, wasn't her original plan. As a child, Sperano loved animals and bugs and things. When she was 8 years old, she even wanted to be a veterinarian. But life took her in a different direction. Her parents were both in business. Her father was in finance, and her mother was an entrepreneur, running her own staffing company. So it didn't surprise anyone when Sperano, too, pursued business, getting her degree at Syracuse. But while at Electronic Data Systems, former presidential candidate Ross Perot's company, she was pulled into a group with other non-technologists. They took people like me and music majors and English majors, and they put us together through their computer training program, she says, recalling the six-week intensive training that kickstarted what would become her career. From there, the promotions kept coming until she became vice president of global support services at Red Hat in Raleigh. The opportunity that would introduce her to two guys that would change her life again, Joe Colopy and Chaz Felix. The pair, who would go on to found Bronto, served separate stints at Red Hat. I knew each of them, but they didn't know each other then, she says. While a post-Red Hat consultant, she happened to run into her old colleague, Colopy, at a coding open house, and she learned he and Felix had started a company with about a dozen people in Durham. They were struggling to run the business and figure out how to do the customer support side, she says, recalling how, when they first offered her a job, she turned them down flat. There were 12 people in the company. For me, I was used to a global organization. But Colopy and Chaz were persistent, so much so that she found herself consulting, agreeing to run the support side of the organization for a couple of months. We all agreed to a 3-month contract, she says, and that was almost 10 years ago. And now, taking the helm from Colopy and Felix, who have left to pursue other projects, she's changing her life yet again. Sperano has spent her triangle life in Cary, is in the process of moving to downtown Durham. Her kids are older, one in college and the other teaching in China. For her, Bronto presented the perfect fit of flexibility and culture. I feel like I made a big difference here, she says. Everybody wants to feel needed. And that's part of her management style and how she retains both the employee base and the culture that attracted her to that 12-person shop. Transparency, approachability, and passion create an open culture, she says. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, and we read the Viewpoint column written by Chris Fitzsimon, who is the founder and executive director of North Carolina Policy Watch in Raleigh. The headline, to repair the HB2 damage, let's start with the problem. It has now been 2.5 months since Governor Pat McCrory signed HB2, the sweeping anti-LGBT law passed by the General Assembly that has cost North Carolina thousands of jobs and damaged the state's reputation around the world. Rumors persist that legislative leaders are working behind the scenes on some sort of compromise, modifications to the law that will lessen its damaging impact on the state. There's talk of a special bipartisan commission headed by former state budget director and GOP benefactor Art Pope and former Lieutenant Governor Dennis Wicker, a Democrat, that will seek to find common ground on the issues raised by HB 2. A few weeks ago, the Charlotte City Council rightly refused to repeal its ordinance that protected LGBT people from discrimination, scuttling what was reportedly a compromise that involved the General Assembly making unspecified changes to HB 2 if Charlotte wiped out its ordinance that the statewide law overruled. Many supporters of HB 2 continue to claim that Charlotte needs to repeal its ordinance first as some sort of symbolic show of good faith that state lawmakers and Governor Pat McCrory will respond to. Other lawmakers seem perfectly comfortable with the law remaining in place until there's a final decision by the courts, never mind the discrimination faced by their constituents or the mounting damage to the state's economy and reputation. Lost in all the talk of compromise and bipartisan commissions and good faith gestures is what's at stake in the entire debate about HB 2, discrimination against LGBT people in North Carolina. It's not just about which bathrooms transgender people use. It never has been, though that's all McCrory and other supporters of the law want to talk about. It's about LGBT people having the same rights as everybody else, protections from being fired or denied services simply because they are gay or bisexual or transgender. And that is the first thing that must happen. We don't need a commission of former politicians to decide whether or not gay people should be discriminated against. McCrory says Congress needs to act to settle the question at the federal level, but in the letter he sent to congressional leaders, he took no position on what they should do, only that they should do something. McCrory needs to publicly demand protections for the LGBT people, too. He is the leader of North Carolina, and HB 2 is his law, and the damage to the state is happening on his watch. HB 2 not only doesn't include protections for LGBT people, it added the term biological sex to the statewide non-discrimination standard because federal courts and the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission have interpreted sex to include sexual orientation and gender identity. In other words, McCrory's law goes out of its way to make sure that LGBT people are not protected from discrimination. If Pope and Wicker want to lead a statewide discussion about bathroom and public facility policies for transgender people to help educate the public and policymakers, that might be useful, and it's worth remembering that more than 200 local governments, including 17 of the 20 largest cities in the country, have ordinances similar to Charlotte's in place and have had no problems. McCrory, Pope, and everyone else who claims to want to address the problems created by HB 2 need to start there, by confronting the discrimination that's at the core of it all. That's what CEOs and performers and tourists want to see, that North Carolina does not openly discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. It's past time for lawmakers and McCrory to make that happen. Enough damage has been done. And in our next Viewpoint column, this one is written by Lee Hamilton, who is a distinguished scholar at Indiana University's School of Global and International Studies and was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for 34 years. The headline, Limited Government Can Be Part of Solution. It has been 35 years since Ronald Reagan's first inaugural speech as president, the one in which he said, "In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem." Over that time, hostility toward government seems only to have grown, led by politicians and embraced by millions of Americans. In this most recent presidential campaign, Republican candidates outdid one another in calling to abolish the agencies that they were running to lead, including the IRS, Department of Education, Environmental Protection Agency, and Department of Energy. I'd argue that limited government is more often part of the solution than it is a problem. It funds core functions, infrastructure, basic research, the court system, education, anti-crime efforts, national security, that allow private markets and the private sector as a whole to flourish. It sustains national parks, interstate highways, libraries, medical research, the air traffic control system, and other services that make this a vibrant society. It strives to protect Americans from hazardous food and drugs, unsafe workplaces, discriminatory employers, and toxic polluters. It has played a key role in asserting fairness for minorities, women, and the most vulnerable people in our society. This is not to say that government does not overreach or that it always performs as it should. On occasion, its leaders make poor and misguided decisions. Its legislators, however well-intentioned, create wasteful and unneeded programs. And every time something like this happens, there are many of us waiting to bash government. But when it performs as it should, few people notice and even fewer of us stand up to defend it. But let's get real here. What's the alternative? We're not going to do away with government, give unfettered free rein to the market, and hope that someone decides to try to make a go of delivering core services. Nor are we going to go all out and establish government ownership of the means of production. So it's crucial for our political leaders to hit a pragmatic note and strive constantly to find the right balance between the two. The fact is, government has not changed much in size over the decades. For the last 50 years, federal net outlays have fluctuated between about 60 and 20% of our gross domestic product, with the occasional dip below or spike above. The total federal workforce stood at 5 million in 1964 and was 4.2 million 50 years later. Whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in office, government doesn't seem to be going away. It is the balance between limited government and the private sector that it's our job constantly to assess, debate, and get right. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move section, where the spotlight is on Heather Cozart, Raleigh office managing partner at Dixon Hughes Goodman, LLP. An accountant by trade, Heather Cozart has taken the next step in her financial services journey by being named managing partner of the Raleigh office of Dixon Hughes Goodman, LLP. In her new role, Cozart works to deliver what she calls creative solutions for DHG's Raleigh employees and clients. This includes coaching, goal setting, strategic thinking, and driving positive change, she says. Charlotte-based DHG is a full-service CPA firm that employs approximately 2,000 professionals in 12 states, and 100 of whom are located in the Triangle. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I wish people knew that a career in accounting, particularly in public accounting, is not boring. I cringe upon hearing the stereotypical description of a CPA. Every day is different for me. Since I joined the firm, no day has been the same as another, and that's why I love my job. What are some of your major goals for your new position? I'd like to ensure the Raleigh office of DHG remains a great place to work and ensure our office continues to make a difference in the community. I also look forward to working with our fabulous team of partners, professionals, and administrative staff in our office to help our clients adapt and thrive in today's continuously changing environment. I also want to continue to foster the culture in which we are like extended family here in the Raleigh office, and we take an interest in both the professional and personal success of each other. Biggest pet peeve? Laziness and people who respond, "That's not my job," when asked to do something. Triangle area business person you most admire? There are so many for different reasons. John Kane, Seppi Saldi, Jim Goodnight, just to name a few. And of course, many of the CEOs of my clients. I am very fortunate to work with some amazing talent. Personal, husband Jared, daughter Paige. Last book you've read? Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us by Daniel H. Pink. And in the Triangle Business Journal now, we turn to the small business section for the column written by James Lee. James Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. The headline on his column, What to do when secession plan hits a long roadblock? Readers of this column might have noticed that I am a little compulsive on the subject of planning for the continuity of family business ownership and management. Like location, location, location in real estate, planning, planning, planning are the three most important things you can do to ensure the successful transfer of your family business from one generation to the next. So, I have to take a few deep breaths before making this admission. There are times when succession planning just doesn't work. Even the most elaborate plan can come apart under certain conditions. Here are a few caveats to keep in mind as your family business starts the succession planning process. Succession planning doesn't work when it feeds the desires of family members at the expense of the needs of the business. The transition from one generation to the next sometimes involves a plan to begin distributing the benefits of ownership, cash or perks, to family members. That can be a dangerous move if family members' desires for a richer lifestyle are allowed to override the business's need for developmental capital and reserves. Succession planning doesn't work when it reflects little more than the senior owner's preferences. While the senior owner is often the key to the success or failure of a succession plan, there's a proven need for objectivity and good business judgment in laying out the plan and implementing it. A good plan provides for the company's stability and growth for many years into the future. It shouldn't be hogtied by the current senior generation's limited choices. Succession planning doesn't work when it makes inadequate provision for the ongoing financial needs of the retiring owner and spouse. Several faults can cause your succession plan to ride low in the water. This little oversight is virtually guaranteed to sink it. It would be unrealistic and just plain dumb for a senior owner to hand over the business, his or her principal financial lifeline, without being certain that a comfortable retirement has been provided for. A mechanism for funding that retirement plan from cash flow, an annuity, a buyout, or some other reliable means should be put into place early in the succession planning process. Succession planning doesn't work when the successors are coerced into coming into the business and taking over its leadership. Even if the senior owners manage to bribe or browbeat the kids into the company as a way of keeping the business in the family, the chances of such an arrangement lasting for more than a few years are pretty slim. Sadly enough, some parents will try anything, guilt trips, threats to disinherit, playing one sibling against another, to keep family ownership intact. A succession plan founded on such low-rent shenanigans comes with a 100% failure guaranteed. Succession planning doesn't work when family members and executives aren't committed to seeing it through. I've seen succession planning processes go on for years longer than necessary because the key actors didn't take the process and its outcomes seriously enough to make tough decisions and allocate required resources. In those cases, the whole notion of planning for continuity of family ownership languished and died, leaving the company's future wrapped up in the senior owner's wills. Bad choice. Succession planning doesn't work when the plan is allowed to sit on the shelf and gather dust. Even the most thorough and thoughtful plan is worthless if it isn't implemented. The family and the company fall into the all talk but no action category of businesses that never realize their great prospects for continued success. Succession planning doesn't work when the planners don't consider the possibility that it might not work. There is no way to insure against unforeseen events, personal, financial, commercial, that can disrupt orderly ownership or management succession. So it's important to have a backup plan in mind to cover as many contingencies as possible. I always push for a plan B when I advise family businesses on succession planning. It's not pessimistic, it's realistic. There are several situations and conditions where succession planning doesn't work. Fortunately, they're all avoidable. And in our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read from some of the list. First, by the numbers, 1,521,052. The number of charitable organizations in the U.S. as of May 2015 according to the Urban Institute National Center for Charitable Statistics. 10,584. The total number of grants made by National Philanthropic Trust in the first 6 months of 2015 on behalf of its donors, representing more than $335 million in mission-critical funding to charities. The total number of grants in the first half of 2015 compared to the same period in 2014 is a 24.5% increase, while the total dollar value of grants to charities increased 49.5%. Durham Charity ranks high on national lists. The CEO of Urban Ministries of Durham recently received a pat on the back from Charity Navigator, a national independent charity evaluator, for running a highly rated charity but taking a paycheck that doesn't break its bank. Urban Ministries has revenue of nearly $2.7 million, yet Executive Director Sheldon Mitchell takes a salary of $85,000. In fact, that ranks the Durham organization fourth in Charity Navigator's top 10. The leaders of these 10 organizations run highly rated charities, yet they earn far less than the average compensation of $150,000 reported by the over 7,000 charities rated, according to Charity Navigator. The low salaries help these charities, which have earned at least two consecutive four-star ratings, devote more than 80% of their budgets to their programs and services. And in a section called North Carolina Givers, North Carolina taxpayers who itemize deductions give an average of 2.5% of their income. This is more than the 2.1% national average, but less than those in South Carolina at 2.6%. North Carolina households that itemize deductions give an average of $1,283, above the national average of $1,204. And about 26% of North Carolina adults volunteer in the community, below the national average of 27%. And we're going to go ahead and stop right there for now as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.